Good evening.
Good evening.
So here is a famous koan taken from the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of koans from ancient China. So in this one, the layman Rico was a very high official in the government in China during the Tang period. And he went to visit his teacher, the very revered Zen teacher, Nansen, who was a very, very famous. So they had a nice visit and a cup of tea. They talked together about the teachings and the practice. And Rico was feeling very good, and he said to Nansen, "You know, the great teacher Sojo proclaimed, 'Heaven and earth and I are of the same root. All things are one.'" And then Rico said, "Isn't that fantastic?" Nansen then got up and gestured for Rico to follow him into the garden, where he pointed to a flower growing out of the pond, and he said to Rico, "People of this time who see this flower are like men in a dream." So that whole thing is inexplicable, of course. Being a koan, it's inexplicable. It is not logical. And to get a sense of its meaning, to comprehend its meaning, the mind must let go of its thinking pattern and let go of conceptualizing to appreciate what Nansen was trying to tell Rico. And of course, this is the way the teachers instructed their students in old China, in the Tang period of China, with these kinds of stories. So in this one, Rico was very pleased and very excited to hear what Sojo had said. And Nansen was trying to point out Rico's misunderstanding. Even though the saying of Sojo, when he said all things are one, everything is of one root, this is full of understanding. But it's wonderful only if Rico is not attached. Rico was really in love with that. "Oh, is that wonderful? Isn't that great?" And Nansen saw that Rico was very much attached to Sojo's saying, attached with his mind to Sojo's saying. He saw that Rico was attached to the idea of oneness. "Isn't that wonderful? We're all one. Isn't that great?" He was attached to the idea of oneness. And that he felt that oneness was being explained by Sojo's teaching. Nansen saw that Rico was infatuated with Sojo and with intellectual concept of oneness. And as long as Rico would cling to the idea of oneness and conceptualized his understanding, that's not true understanding. It's like, "Oh, I get it." means you really don't. His conceptual idea of what Sojo had said was not true understanding. Even though the idea of oneness is not wrong. Nansen tries to show Rico, if you see this flower with attachment, you cannot truly see it. You see it as if you were in a dream. So he said, the men of today see this flower as if in a dream. If you're attached to this flower, you really don't see it. No matter how beautiful it is, and no matter how much you are touched by it and appreciate it and are inspired by it, if you are attached to its beauty, you cannot really see it. And so in this story, the layman, the high government official, Rico, he represents people who seek satisfaction from the objective, from an objective worldly viewpoint, or a very logical viewpoint. And this includes people who are attached to their own view of what is right, what is wrong, what is good, or what is bad, and therefore cannot see things as they really are. And Nansen had been around. He had a lot of experience. He was very wise in a very subtle way. And he saw Rico's mind, saw Rico's mind. He saw how Rico was attached to the idea of oneness and how he was so pleased with himself. Oh, isn't that great? Look at me. I understand oneness. And Nansen saw that Rico was showing off. And so he said, you're in a dream. So Suzuki Roshi once gave a talk where he talked about how when we see something or listen to someone, usually what we see and hear are just echoes of ourself. We listen to someone, but we are hearing only our own mind, not what is really being said. And because we are attached to our own view. And we filter what we hear through that bias, through our own way of thinking, through what we prefer and to what pleases us. He was talking about the true difficulty of listening completely, without discrimination, how hard that really is for us. So, when we think about when we think about Buddhism, when we think about our practice, and when we talk about, discuss what it is, what we think it is, usually our understanding is not complete. Not complete. And that's because our words and the logic of our mind, not perfect. And our preconceptions will screen and distort what we say or hear. So our understanding of Buddhism and of our practice cannot be fully appreciated. According to Buddhism, mistakes, the mistakes that we make are not an accident. we do not make mistakes without a reason. It's interesting to consider. We do not make mistakes without a reason. And it is because we do not see things as they are. Even though these eyes are good, and this mind is good, and all of our senses work well, we make mistakes. Because when we do not see things as they truly are, when our brain is left alone to function naturally, it works fine. It works okay. But according to Buddhist teachings, we have a faculty in addition to the six senses. We have an ego-oriented faculty that distorts our judgment. And when our understanding is influenced by our ego, we cannot have right understanding. And we cannot have universal understanding. Instead, we have an ego-centered and a very partial understanding. This is the faculty in addition to our six senses. So this is a problem for humans. I don't think animals have this problem, because they don't have the capacity to reason and to think. This is a problem for humans. And so without realizing that we are making a mistake, we insist on our own ideas and our own feelings, and we put forth ego-centered ideas. But Buddhist teaching tells us there is a way out of this problem, because according to the teaching, we have yet another faculty. I'll tell you about it. Yeah. Buddhism says that in addition to our six senses and our ego faculty, we have an eighth faculty that corrects the mistakes of the ego. We have a faculty that, if we allow it, can tell us, "You are distorting. You are adding something to what you see or hear." And when that faculty is working, when we realize that we have a tendency to see and hear as if an echo of ourself, when we realize we have that seventh faculty that distorts, that recognition is in itself a step towards enlightenment. Because that is a step towards dropping the conceptualization of truth, conceptualizing truth according to our own preferences. When we realize we do that through our eighth faculty, that's a step towards enlightenment and wisdom. (Clears throat) And maybe you have experienced this. Maybe in Zazen, and maybe when you're doing something else, when you say, oh, look what my mind does. Look at the way I distort things. Look at the way I twist things. Oh my goodness. When our mind acts in a discriminatory way, it loses its subtlety. And sees things in a dualistic way. What Buddhism calls dualistic. I like this, but I don't like that. And she is great, he's not great. When the dualistic mind starts to work like that, it means we believe that the mind is permanent. And that belief is a reflection of our attachment. So the truth is that our mind is not permanent, but we want things to be permanent. Feel safe to believe that things are permanent. No ambiguity. We want things to be permanent, especially if they are attractive. And if they're not attractive, we don't want them to be permanent. This is the dualistic mind. So if something is attractive, we say, please stay. And if it's not attractive, we say, please go. So when we are attached to things in that way, it means we don't know how our mind is working. Usually we feel that our mind is working just fine. My mind is working okay. But when we understand something according to our prejudices, we fool ourselves into thinking that our mind is permanent. And when we have some idea of the permanence of mind, we will attach to what we observe and assign it also quality of permanence. And then we start to see things in terms of concepts and not how they really are. We see things in terms of labels or preferences, but that's just attachments. If we are guided by what Suzuki Roshi tells us, when we can only hear and see an echo of ourself, our mind becomes very rough. And it loses its capacity for subtlety. Without the capacity for subtlety, we cannot see things as they really are. We cannot see things with a universal mind. That is, with full understanding, with wisdom. And when our mind is not subtle, the body and mind feel uneasy, ill at ease. And you can see this sometimes in people, how uncomfortable they seem to feel in their own skin. Their body language gives away that they are ill at ease in the body and mind. And it's because they have not been able to see things as they truly are. So we practice to keep an open mind when hearing, when seeing, and when thinking. Keep an open mind, keep an expanded mind. And in that way, we won't be listening to an echo of ourself. And that way, we will have no problem of life. It's driven by dreams. So this was Nansen's genius. He could see Enrico. He could see how ill at ease Rico was in his body and mind, even though he was so enthusiastic about the idea that all things are one. Nansen tried to show him it's a dream. Don't be attached to it. So we practice to notice when we are attached, when our mind is not expanded, but being influenced by prejudices and dreams. Does anyone have a question tonight? Scott.
What does the truth feel like?
Drink of cold water on a hot day. Ken.
Thank you very much for this talk tonight. It helped me gel an incident that happened to me a couple of nights ago. And I was with some friends, and we were having a conversation and having a good time. And then I made a comment that was pretty off color, and they kind of took him back, and took me back too. And I thought, where did that come from? And it's puzzled me for the last couple of days. I'm like, I don't say that, but I did say something like that, right? And what I realized with your talk was, I was kind of being a character in my own stories, and that character would say things like that, and when it kind of popped me out of it, I didn't get it for a while, and I, yeah, it's, it's the reflection of, sometimes we see the reflection of what we want to see, or what we think we want to be, and not letting that go. I like Scott's question, you know, what is the truth like? And sometimes for me, I don't know what the truth's like until I touch it, and then it's unmistakable what it is. But it's the constant letting go, and I think of experience I have is that these stories are so subtle, or maybe they're so pervasive. It's a fish swimming in the ocean and not really knowing what the water is really like and what character. And these stories sometimes, for me, can be that way. They can touch all the boundaries of my experiences and stuff, and then something comes along and says, no, you've been making this all up to a certain degree. This isn't really truth, and this isn't really who you are. And when that happens, you know, I feel like I have touched the truth for a moment at least. And then the clouds come back in. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, Jaya, how are you?
I realize that sometimes the, back to Scott's question, I guess Candace's comment, sometimes even when you feel like you know truth, or you think you've touched truth, it isn't. It can be not so. So I think sometimes even the wanting to know truth, or to know something is, can be a form of attachment. So I felt in my gut that is just how it is. And I've been so convinced that is just, has to be that way, or you feel it in your bones, you feel it, like, and then it isn't. And then you realize that even that wanting to be in that place of where you feel like you really know is like that form of attachment. And so I just kind of, I've experienced that at times where I wanted so much to be in that space, and then I realize afterwards that, oh, that's like an attachment. So I just thought I'd sit down. Kind of like the story of him wanting to know that being one with everything. It's like the desire to want to be, know the truth and feel like you know it. This can be pretty difficult.
Thank you. Yes, Anna?
Maybe this is similar to what Jayshree is saying, but sometimes when I catch myself in dualistic thinking, I think something is good or bad or right or wrong, I'll follow it. So I'll think, oops, and I'll think, what is that really? And I'll get into a very analytical way of thinking based on the Dharma and based on my experience. And I'm hoping that process will go away. Because getting attachments of that way of thinking and being so analytical and picking it apart of, if that's not bad, what is it really? What was my mind doing? And where is the ego, or what's the harm or suffering? Other ways to look at it. What would your advice be on how to realize your error, but not be so attached to the Dharma or those analytical ways? Do you have advice on how to stop?
So give your complete attention to whatever it is you have to do in the moment, and let you know your wisdom inform you will this create harm? Will this prevent harm? Will this create good? Just subtly appreciating that when you do something. That's all you have to do. We should be, you know, like a cat or a dog in moments like that. They don't think about it. Here's something I have to do, and to do it. No thinking. So if you've developed the capacity to see things subtly, you'll know that what you are doing or what you intend to do will be creative or not. And you'll be guided on what to do and how to do it. But to do that, we have to give the thinking mind a rest. Sit down for a minute. You know, there are some well-known popular stories about Zen practice where somebody comes to see the teacher and says, well, I have this problem. He goes on and on about his problem. The teacher says, have a cup of tea. It's like saying, can you just give your mind a rest for a couple of minutes? Let's just do something where we don't have to think about and enjoy a cup of tea together. Put aside the mind for a minute because it's driving you crazy. So we have to do that with ourselves, you know, maybe moment by moment. Just let's enjoy the moment, and then we'll know what to do. Thank you. To Umar.
The last 2 weeks ago, we were in Hawaii. We went to the Peace Garden.
Which garden?
It was called the Peace Garden.
Oh, Peach Garden.
Peace
yeah. Garden.
So they had a tree with a Hindu god, and they had Mother Mary. They had Tibetan mudra. Tibetan person there. Made a Tibetan statue, and they had different religions. I actually walked into one of the Indian sort of circular things. It was it's sort of like a labyrinth. You have to go to the middle. And when your lecture reminded me that when I was walking in towards, you have to walk into a circle. It's like it goes round and round, but it doesn't really go round. It looks like it's going round, but it'll deceive you the way that it's supposed to. You get your mind kind of a little confused. You're thinking, oh, we're just going to walk around, it's going to go in the middle. No, it doesn't go this way. One will go this way, the other one will go this way, and it goes back and forth till you end up in the middle. And I found that while I was walking, I was gently and slowly walking into it, I was thinking, this is very interesting that I'm feeling a resistance in myself that I don't want to go in. And when I had gone right to the middle of the circle, I didn't want to come out. It was interesting. I was like, wow, these are two resistances that I never realized that I had. But it was just like, because my mind wasn't used to functioning in that sort of back and forth way. So I had to just completely let go and said, no, I'm just going to walk. That's all I'm going to do. But I felt this sense of resistance of going in or wanting to come back out. I thought, wow, this is really interesting how something this simple can create a resistance in a person. And I felt it. It was just, wow, this is amazing.
You'll have to tell me where it is. I'd like to go there. On the Big Island.
On the Big Island. Big it's island. Called the Peace Garden. Yeah.
Okay. Near the volcano?
No, Paliakala.
Oh, Paliakala.
Yeah.
Okay, good. You'll draw me a map later. Thank you. Yes, Carolina.
I'm asking these questions because I really don't know. Do cats and dogs have egos?
I don't know. What I do know is that my cat, our cat, is very friendly. And she likes to have conversations with us. And we talk to each other. And I think we understand each other. That's all I know. Thank you. Yes, Sylvia. It's because you don't recognize that you already have everything you need.